Watts, a former FBI agent, U.S. Army officer, and leading cybersecurity expert, offers a frightening look at the misinformation campaigns, the fake news, and the electronic espionage operations that have become the cutting edge of modern warfare. His book, Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News, is published by HarperCollins, and I am pleased it brings him to our show. Welcome, Clint.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So you testified in front of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence regarding Russian interference in the 2016 elections last year. That was not long after President Trump had taken office. Did you find them receptive to your argument that the Russians had interfered in our elections?
Yeah, I had actually been doing basically that briefing for a year and a half or so before that. And so we had myself, J.M. Berger, Andrew Weisberg, written up our analysis 2 days before the election and put it out there because we kind of knew political partisans would take it each way. And we sort of wanted to say, look, this is what's been going on. And so I was thrilled that they asked me to come. And I was really surprised when they listened because, you know, everyone was worried about ISIS and 2015 and 16. And so getting people to listen to Russian disinfo was very difficult. So I was impressed that the Intel Committee really, they did listen. And I've seen some pretty good work there, actually restoring my hope in democracy a bit.
And that's a good reminder of how quickly and dramatically our conversations, public discourse change our point of focus at that time, ISIS, as you point out. When you testified, Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg admitted that their platform had been used for influence at that point?
I think they were still in the research phase, a little bit in denial, but also knew something was going on. Remember, the French election was coming up next, and right. They did get in front of that. They shut down a lot of accounts. I want to say 30,000. You'd have to fact check me on that. But they knew something was amiss. And so the social media companies were going back and trying to figure it out. And Facebook actually has been the most aggressive on that. They've solved, not solved it, but they've detected and sort of rooted out a lot of it.
And how about Twitter at that point and now?
No, Twitter at that time, I think, was still flat-footed. It just did not know. And it was only after the other social media companies pushed forward that I think they kind of picked up on what was going on. And even today, you know, Twitter will struggle indefinitely because it's an open system. They just don't know much about their users. It's very easy to make a false account there or a social bot. And so they'll always have a tougher time because of the nature of the design of their platform.
Right. Well, in your testimony, you said that, quote, the Russians have used social media-driven information campaigns to discredit the U.S. for years. Facebook and Twitter remain littered with pro-Russian, Western-looking accounts and supporting automated bots designed to undermine the credibility of the U.S. government. How long had their misinformation campaign been going on?
Depending on the audience, really up to 5 to 6 years. I think the way to sort of look at it is they started off by experimenting on their own population. The Russian population has suffered the most from this, and really that disinformation system. We forget that, but that's their primary focus, which is domestic control of information. Beyond that, in 2013-14 was really the testing in Ukraine and Syria. That's where they were trying this influence, and that's how we stumbled onto them. And then from 15 to 16, it's been widespread across the Western world that they have tried to both influence elections, but also win over audiences inside Western democracies.
So their work in Syria and the Ukraine was really the place where the U.S. government really turned its focus and became alerted to this activity in a focused way.
I don't know that they did. I think Rick Stengel, who worked at the State Department, wrote up a really good summary of what he saw it from the State Department's perspective around Ukraine. And we were seeing it from Syria. But what they were doing was taking really a few components and testing them out. They were using hacking to power influence. That was new. No one had really done that. They were also using false personas, or what we call black propaganda, to make it look like and feel like people that are from the target audience. That's a very different technique as well. So you might see a terrorist, you know, try and rally their base, but this is actually making a fake account to rally a foreign audience base. That's a new technique, and it was very successful.
You write that Russian social media influence operations is really just an update of their old Soviet playbook known as active measures. What are active measures and how do they play out during the Soviet years?
Yeah, the Soviet Union knew they could not really match the West, NATO and the United States on the battlefield. So they created active measures, which was, use the force of politics rather than the politics of force to win over against your asymmetrically against your adversary. So go in, win their populations, win their elections, influence their politics, tie them up domestically in terms of battles. That will open space for you to do what you want overseas in terms of your foreign policy. Soviet Union really couldn't get this off the ground because back then, to run a communist newspaper in America or to have people write articles or even read the stuff was very difficult. You'd have FBI agents tracking down. We watched the Americans TV show. That's right. You know, it's much challenging. When this moves to social media, though, it becomes far easier, and there is no real cost to production. It's a lowered barrier of entry. So you just see them take that approach. And what the Soviet transition to the Russian disinfo was, they realized the only thing worse than no information is too much information. It's information annihilation. So rather than try and control all the information, just sour or taint all of it and just pump so much that the public can't figure out what's going on.
Overwhelm them. Yeah, and sort of 20th century example you just gave of the difficulty of putting together a communist newspaper in the States is well taken, because here we just see that the distribution is there. That changes everything.
Yeah, it's free, easy, cheap. You can do content production immediately. And the other thing you can do is you can grab onto U.S. audience content that supports your narratives and just repump it into the information space. It's basically your audience the audience you're targeting is producing the content you need to influence them.
You're not even generating narratives. You're supporting the narratives that are already out there in the ethos. You began monitoring influencing operations in January 2014 after you co-authored an article for Foreign Affairs, The Good and the Bad of Ahrar al-Sham. Who is Ahrar al-Sham?
Ahrar al-Sham at that time was an Islamist group in Syria, and they were fighting against the regime. But they were also being buddied up to and curried by extremist jihadists, namely al-Qaeda. And so we were trying to look, this is during the smart power days of Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, you know, pushing that direction. We're like, well, if they're not going to deploy U.S. military into Syria, how do we fight in this space and keep terrorists really from taking hold of the movement? So the idea was the good and bad of Ahrar al-Sham. Ahrar al-Sham is an Islamist group, but can we negotiate with them to try and vie for them to moderate as opposed to being recruited into al-Qaeda's ranks? And when I put that out, that's when I started to get my first rounds of incessant trolling. Like, I have been trolled a lot before, but this was very different. It was automated. Same phrases, different personas, the uniform distribution around the world, all night and day. And that was the first of the social bots, really, that we started to pick up on.
What do you think it was in your own personal experience that made that be the first time you experienced that? Was there something particular about this work?
I think the Russian disinfo system wanted to assert Assad should stay in power. It's the only real counter to terrorists. That was the narrative that was grabbing there. And that was very much a Russian narrative. And when you first looked at it, it looked to be pro-Syrian. But when you started to cut much, much more deeper, you would see the overlapping networks with the Russian message. And once you stayed on that over time, the next real phase of it, we saw a petition on the White House website that was called Alaska Back to Russia. The bot that was hitting it oftentimes spoke in Russian, so it's not really that hidden. And we couldn't imagine how were, 40, 50, 60,000 Americans really signing this White House petition. And when we started to map it out, it was clear it was inauthentic. It was a manufactured electronic signature.
The haunting thing to me is, now as we learn so much about all of the work that was going on to spread this misinformation, to relate it back to these news pegs that we were experiencing. I mean, I remember that story. I remember that petition. And now we see it through an entirely different lens. Did you try to draw out these trolls? Did you engage them at that point?
Yeah, at some points I would actually, push back at them because I wanted to see response times. I wanted to see they say the same phrases as other accounts are saying. And people commonly see this now because there's enough social bots out there. If you watch President Trump's Twitter conversations, you'll see enormous social bots on all sides. And so at that time, I was trying to figure out, are these real or fake? Who is coordinating with who? And what are the links, essentially, that they're pushing back against me? And they tend to share the same ones. And that's really how you map out an influence network. And, we should all note that some people are authentic. They really believe in their cause, but they don't always know that they're unwittingly being paired with people that are inauthentic.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Clint Watts, a former FBI special agent, about his new book, Messing with the Enemy, published by HarperCollins. What did the FBI tell you to do to protect yourself, or did they give you any advice?
Yeah, you know, when it comes to hacking, the FBI generally just gives you notifications, you know, if you've been targeted. And it's normal for the FBI not to tell you the actor. They may not know, or they may not want to tell you because they're doing their investigative research. It can blow a cyber investigation, you know, it can really damage it. So it basically just comes down to, hey, you know, you've been targeted with a hack, and that's probably because of something you wrote. We wanted to let you know. And from the FBI's perspective, this was going on in the number of thousands, you know, per month. So that notification process, the same one we talk about with the DNC. Hey, why didn't you do more of the DNC? Well, they were one of many that day they probably had to do a notification of. And so it's a challenge for the FBI to both investigate all these hacks and pick which ones to really invest their time in.
And you've had an interesting career where you've, you know, worked within government agencies and done a lot of work on your own. Did the FBI know you'd been monitoring Russian trolls over the years?
I had done briefings, actually, at counterterrorism functions, you know, mostly academic community things, and government reps, you know, go to those. And so they would hear the briefing, but I think whether it was the public or the government in 15 and 16, there was a disbelief that it was actually making a difference, you know, that it's actually moving audiences or people are actually engaging with it. Sometimes I'll see critics look at a Facebook ad the Russians did and said, that's stupid, so obviously it didn't work. But I can tell you this, there's always somebody that actually goes for it. When you go back and look at 20,000 people watched it, you know, or engaged with that content, and it's just one. What they actually did is they persisted over 2.5 years, you know, in the U.S. audience space. They were there. They also run many, many iterations. And the other big thing is they're cross-platform. So you don't realize oftentimes a Twitter account over here is linking to a YouTube channel that's here, which is posting from an RT page that's in a group on Facebook. So it's hard on any one social media platform to understand the scale because they can only see in their tunnel, you know, in that atmosphere.
Right. And but to your point about, you know, just that one person taking the information in, I mean, that can generate two or three or five conversations, you know. So it's easy to see how this grows.
Yeah, and when you look at the Internet Research Agency, the Troll Farm, and the Twitter accounts that have been closed down and attributed to them, there are so many that were cited either by the mainstream news or repeated by the Trump campaign going into the election that it is quite shocking and damning to look at. And there's been lots of friends that I've had actually get those notifications says you probably interacted with a Russian account. And it's alarming to them, you know, when they look back, but it's been 2 years. You know, it's hard to get your head around sometimes. It's so much after the fact.
Some of the campaigns run by the Russians we know a little more about, like their use of Black Lives Matter,
right,
grassroots organizations. How did the Russians capitalize on that movement in particular?
Yeah, so what the Russians do that's so much more effective and more sophisticated than the Americans, they try everything. So they are not particular necessarily in terms of one audience out at the start. In America, we always design an advertising campaign to go after a certain voter or a product or whatever it might be. They don't look at it that way. They go across the entire spectrum and they're looking for anything that's an anti-government or a divisive issue and they test it. And so Black Lives Matter is a great one where you had law enforcement versus a public civil protest. You had a very deliberate angle that lines up naturally against political groups. And so what they do that's very smart is they try all social issues and test them out, and where they find success, they amplify it. On the right, they had great success in the Trump supporters, but on the left, they had some success on social issues, particularly transparency enthusiasts around government secrets, those sorts of things. And they will push on both of those. The way they do this, which is very effective, is they infiltrate on social issues. Then they influence you on political. So you start in 2015 to see them testing out social issues, race, religion, Second Amendment rights, abortion rights, all of these very touchy issues. If you can get in there and make friends on those issues, later you can push them towards candidates you want in an election year.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with former FBI Special Agent Clint Watts about his new book, Messing with the Enemy. I'm D.W. Gibson, speaking with Clint Watts about his new book, Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News, published by HarperCollins. Clint, we were talking about the Black Lives Matter movement just before the break. Were there other racial tensions that the Russians tried to exploit, capitalize on?
Yeah, one of the bigger issues was religion, immigration, and really for Muslims or against Muslims, you know, trying to play that issue. So orchestrating rallies, that was one of the ones that has come out of the Facebook posts and advertisements. Another one was secessionist movements, so Texas exit or California exit. Those, that is a big part of it. You know, can we break up unions? And what they do, what the Russians do so much better than Americans do in terms of trying to advance their agenda is they don't separate the physical world and the virtual world. They see it as sort of one and the same. And so the goal as a propagandist is to create a behavior change in your target audience. So not only did they recruit an audience, but they actually sent them to physical protest down in Texas, a campaign event in Florida, and convinced people to do things. And one of the key things they would say to them is, make sure when you get there that you take pictures. Mm-hmm. They need those pictures because then in the virtual world, they can power that and say, look at what's going on. There is huge racial and religious, you know, tensions in the United States. Democracy does not work. It's falling apart. Black Lives Matter versus cops. Cops versus, look at what's going on. It's a race riots in America. They want to show that instability. They want to show democracy to be collapsing. And they're really good at that. America doesn't get it. We'll say, I'll give you an example. The girls captured by Boko Haram. That was a huge social media thing in the United States. And right. They would say, bring back, you know, save our girls, bring back our girls. But never did we actually enlist people to go rescue the girls in Nigeria. That's not how the Russians think. They want to see an actual provocation occur so that they know that their influence is successful, but it also powers then in a reverse way in the online space.
They're looking for action. And, you know, when you mention these secessionist conversations, on the one hand, Americans might say, well, this is ludicrous. It sounds like a fringe story. But then we end up talking about it. It ends up occupying the space we all share, right?
Yeah, and it gained a lot of traction. I mean, you saw a lot of real-world Americans in Texas or California, Alaska, that these are pride, you know, state pride.
Right.
And the whole idea of the Russian strategy is called devolution, which is break any union into its smaller parts. And one-on-one, then, we can go and overtake these. So NATO, the EU, if we can break up NATO and the EU, we can overtake any of those countries alone. And in the United States, they're not going to be worried about us if they're trying to deal with their Texas exit problem. And so while we sort of laugh about it, oh, no one would ever leave, I can tell you this. I would not be surprised in 8 to 12 years, you saw a major political candidate in the U.S. run on a platform of breaking up the United States of America. No, I don't think they'll win, but that one would even
It'll be in the public conversation.
Right. The whole idea that it would be in the public conversation is quite stunning, you know, this far into our history.
Absolutely. Is it possible in hindsight to identify the populations in America that are most vulnerable to Russian efforts? Are they less educated, young, old?
Yeah, you know, this is... I have a very different perspective on it. When I brief a Congress, for example, they'll say, man, we need to educate our young people about this. And I say, no, you don't. Yeah, you know, young people have actually figured it out. If you watch the social media that they move to, like Snapchat, that's more about trusted networks and friends. They like temporary posts because they don't want it to damage the rest of their life.
Right.
The people I'm worried about are retirees because they are coming into cell phones, smart apps, social media late in life, and they're not used to assessing information sources. So if I'm a propagandist, the people I would go to are retirees who don't know information sources on social media and have a lot of time on their hands.
And tend to vote.
And that is a great advocate to win over if you're trying to do influence. It's very different from what we traditionally think.
So we touched on this a bit at the outset, but what steps have social media platforms like Twitter, Instagram, Reddit, Facebook taken to combat Russian efforts?
It's interesting to see the different approaches that are out there. Facebook has taken a lot of heat, but I have to say of any of the platforms, they've been the most aggressive about turning direction towards it. And I think they've put a lot of manpower against it. They realize the threat it is to their platform, you know, beyond just the regulation and scrutiny that people, if they don't trust their platform, they will walk away. Twitter has just recently done something that I think is pretty positive, which is changing the sort of community algorithm, meaning if you're a troll, you're constantly yelling or screaming at people that are outside of your network, you know, you're trying to badger people, they're going to lower essentially the quality or the reach of your message, and I think that's good. And I really like how Reddit has responded. They've been a little bit later to it, but they have done some of the best public announcements about it. So they're getting there, and I actually think it's interesting that they're getting there. even though Congress is not. You know, simple things like the Honest Ads Act, which just takes the provisions for print, radio, television that a political campaign or a social action group would have to do here,
right,
and put it in social media, that still has not passed in Congress, which is fascinating to me. You've seen the social media companies somewhat do that on their own, just anticipating that will happen, and also because I think they worry about the trust and confidence of their users in their platforms.
So that's a good example of something that could be done that would be very helpful. Are there other things out there that you think are a part of the solution that we're not grabbing yet?
Yeah, the election interference component of it, the hacking or you know, what Russia was trying to do was hack voter rolls or databases to create the impression that maybe your vote didn't count or was inauthentic. They can then advance that conspiracy in the public space, erodes trust in democracy, which is part of active measures. Election machines, infrastructure, securing them, paper ballot backups to ensure authenticity. There are a lot of things we can do, and I thought the Senate Intel Committee actually did a very good report. I think it was about 45 days ago, and we're starting to see some movement there, but that should have happened within 45 days of the election once we had seen this happen.
Right.
The big challenge is news and information sources. How do we help the consumer understand the information they're consuming? And I always give them an example. Why don't you read the conspiracy magazines at the checkout counter in the grocery store every day for your real news? People say, well, I know it's nonsense, aliens didn't land. I said, but why would you read that online? Well, it's because my friend shared it with me and I trust my friend.
Right.
There's a way we have to work, you know, with social media companies to help the user make good decisions for themselves.
It's the sort of false sense of vetting that social media gives us that's really insidious.
Right. It's the implicit bias. You want to trust information comes from people you trust and people you know and people that are like you. And your crazy uncle who sends you the crazy email isn't meaning to dupe you. He's also believing it too. So it's sort of, it's a transitive property of information flow. And it's something that manipulators understand. We have to help, you know, the user understand that.
So all things considered, are Americans more vulnerable today than we were in the 2016 cycle? I mean, taking into consideration these steps that have been made by these different companies, how do you see the lay of the land now?
Yeah, I'm not worried about the Russians in 2018. I'm worried about the Americans, meaning that the most sophisticated influencers have seen the art of the Russian disinfo system and they are applying science to it. So if you're a political manipulator and you have access to everyone's data and machine learning, artificial intelligence applications, which allow you to comb through it much quicker, you can design an influence campaign on steroids that looks more authentic and is way more devastating. That will come from those that have money and technology. And that won't be the Russians. That will be public relations firms, trolling as a service. You know, we were talking about Cambridge Analytica and some of these. They're just the one we know about. I'm more worried about how the information space gets destroyed when everyone is using this approach. I think for most people that are not on the extremes, they are backing away from social media and information sources because they don't trust it. And that can lead to apathy. We sort of see that in authoritarian regimes where you just say, I don't know what to believe, so I'm not even going to participate in democracy. I'm just exhausted. And then that leaves things like social media where on the extremes, left or right, you just have partisans who are screaming back and forth at each other. And I think that's not only a threat to our country, but to the social media platforms themselves. If the user experience is so negative, why would you do it over time? And I think that's what they're wrestling with today.
I'm D.W. Gibson speaking with Clint Watts about his book, Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News, published by HarperCollins. So President Trump denied for a very long time that the Russians had interfered in the 2016 campaign, fearing it would delegitimize his presidency. He even denied it in the face of all the intelligence agencies agreeing that it had taken place. To what degree has the president come on board with the reality of the Russian interference as you see it?
I just don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, here is my fear with the president and his comments, whether it's about Russian disinfo or another conspiracy, is does he repeat them for a political advantage and to rally his base, or does he actually believe them? And then I think the next question is, which is worse, that he's doing it for manipulative purposes, or does he actually believe some of these false conspiracies? I think the latter is more concerning because that makes me nervous for the entire country that when we hit a real crisis, it could lead to partisanship that is not good for America. And so with the Russian disinfo campaign, I think at this point he must believe it, but he could really protect our country by stepping up. And in terms of leadership, the thing we need right now is to say, we're not going to deal with Russian disinfo anymore. And you people in the government, you're in charge for it, and I expect you to defend us. I haven't seen that happen yet.
It sounds like you're a little bit more encouraged on with Congress in the report out of the Senate Intelligence.
I am with the Senate. I'm less so yeah. with the House. I mean, the House seems to have become a political battleground, you know, between the two parties. But I have to say, I was encouraged, nervous but encouraged after going to the Senate Intel Committee, a little over a year ago. And I've seen them sort of work together, you know, for the most part. I've seen those senators, Democrats and Republicans, put together some recommendations that were very good. And I feel like they are one of those anchors we have to hope brings us through this particularly partisan time. I was pretty negative about Capitol Hill, and I was, as a executive branch guy, I didn't usually go there a whole lot. And so to go testify four times in a year to the Senate committees, for the most part, I had a really positive experience. And I saw senators working together, even though it might play out a drama on television. I feel like they generally had the best interests of America. And so I think that's a good sign for democracy. Maybe we'll restore the Senate through all of this turmoil in the end.
We can only hope they do better work when the cameras are turned off. So I want to go back to voting machines. Since the 2016 election, we have also learned that the voting rolls were purged, as you mentioned, in some cities and states, and the voting machines themselves were hacked. Is there any effort to protect the voter rolls and voting machines? I mean, have we taken steps to address those things you mentioned?
Yeah, this is one of the things the DHS has, I believe, double check me on this, declared them critical infrastructure. They're putting resources into that. You've seen state election officials now pairing up with federal election officials. Hopefully, I think this is happening, DHS will share more of the cyber signatures of hackers with state and locals and provide them, you know, more warning of what's going on. And I'm hoping that the analog backup to the digital is there so we can always do a recount if need be, if someone were to take down a machine. What I'm most concerned about is the conspiracy. Can we make sure we keep the conspiracy at bay and that we're providing enough evidence of truth that we are protecting the vote or have a backup if something goes wrong? And I would like to hear a little bit more about what is the playbook on Election Day 2018 whenever a conspiracy gets launched on the internet, we know it's going to happen, or social media, and how do we respond to that? I think that's the one piece I haven't heard about, and I would like to hear either state and local or the federal level say, here's how we're going to team up to ensure the public that, yes, our democracy is protected.
Yeah, and that's a great point to underscore, because it's not just about creating systems to protect the voting information, the votes themselves, but communicating to the public that plan so the right. public has confidence in it.
Yeah, you have to have a quick response. Refuting falsehoods, it has to happen quickly. The longer that it goes on, the more the conspiracy can grow and spread. And once it's out there, it's very hard to push it back down. People will believe that which they hear first and that which they hear most often. And so the quickest way to get to that is some baseline of truth and with a official refutation from a credible source.
So undermining the integrity of our elections is obviously something we experienced from the Russians, but it's not just the United States, right? I mean, the Russians are targeting other places in the world. Can you talk about their efforts in Europe and elsewhere?
Yeah. So, you know, after the United States, before the United States was Brexit, after was France and Germany. And they have been doing this, you know, throughout Eastern European countries, you know, for some time. And it's a very smart strategy. The other European countries after us did better for a few reasons. One, they were a little bit inoculated to it. When every time you run the playbook, more people catch on to it. But the other thing is their democracies are structured actually in a way that's more resilient to this. They don't have their presidential elections for 18 months. I mean, that gives you a lot of time to influence. The other thing is they have runoff systems. You know, so in France, right. You saw several candidates going in. Then they narrow down to two. 2 weeks later, they have a final election. Even if you knock out one candidate, everyone's votes fall to whoever, you know, fell behind that other candidate. So Marine Le Pen was going to face somebody else with all of Macron's votes. There's also some things we can learn, you know, from the Europeans, and that they're a little bit more inoculated to this because they don't consume as much of their information, at least as of yet, off social media. Their news consumption is about half of what the United States is. Hmm. So it's much tougher to influence them solely from cyberspace. You know, you have to get in their actual friends' networks. And so it makes them a little more resilient. And the last part is really it's hard to compromise a Frenchman. You know, they will take on more, unless it's a financial crime, a real hard crime. They don't sweat the social issues the same way. And as we've seen pre and post-election now with the Stormy Daniels scandal and other things, our social issues are really a vulnerability that can be manufactured or used in a compromising situation. So that really helps in terms of their influence game. We could shorten our election. We could have more candidates. We could get rid of superdelegates. And ultimately, the Electoral College works against us because it means our competition only comes down to a few states. And if you want to game that, all you have to do is watch cable news at night and you'll know which states are in play.
Right. And it gives the Russians and other entities a place to focus. Absolutely.
That's right. I mean, the minority of the vote picked the winner this time. And that's happened twice in the last, I think, five elections mm-hmm. now. And so that really helps you target as a foreign influence operation exactly where to invest your effort. You don't have to win 50 states. You only got to win 2, 3, or 4.
One thing that really comes through in the book is the critical eye you turn toward the institutions of U.S. government. You write early on in the book, quote, "The only two constants during my professional career have been curiosity and contempt for bureaucracy. I almost got the feeling that in the end you think it's the individual and not any government agency or body that will have to combat the social media environment. Or do you still see government agencies as critical to the fight?"
I see institutions as critical for defending democracy. I think surviving through this will come down to civil society. Freedom of the press and freedom of speech are two of our greatest attributes as a country. We can only protect that so much by using the government without them impeding upon it in one way or another or showing bias. Social media companies now are more in that role than ever. They are constantly trying to say, am I a neutral platform for all my participants? Am I censoring people? Am I protecting their free speech? And at the same point, it will come down to civil society to decide how much they want to fight for democracy, how much they want to fight for their values. Part of the reason we're suffering so bad as a country right now is we couldn't punch back against Russia if we wanted to in the information space because we don't have our feet on the ground. What do we believe in? Our president, you know, is a sane anti-NATO, anti-EU, anti-immigration, nationalism, not globalism. That's also what Vladimir Putin is saying. So what are we going to answer back with? We used to know what our democratic values were. We stood for openness, free and fair elections. You know, everybody has a right to choose. A lot of social justice issues. We're not really standing for that now. So what would we punch back with? And until our country sort of gets its feet to, you know, on the ground and gets itself together and we come to a common understanding of what we believe in, we can't punch back against anyone's foreign influence. And we're really just fighting amongst ourselves. That's why this stuff works so well.
So there are things that the government can do to push back on these efforts. What would you say to the individual American who wants to protect themselves and their own sort of personal sovereignty, as it were? What advice would you give to them?
I think the big thing is value physical relationships more than virtual relationships. What we are doing right now is we're spending more and more time online or on our phones. I think the average is, when you look at it, is 3 to 5 hours on a smartphone. So look at your waking hours. You're spending 3 or 5 hours with people that you aren't physically with. And you're building bonds with a virtual world that I call it social media nationalism in the book. Those social media nations are overtaking real world nations. This has happened in several different ways. You know, the dynamics I talk about in the book, the Arab Spring over authoritarians, ISIS over Al-Qaeda. They really destroyed an established terrorist group. The Trump bubble over the GOP establishment. I'm not saying they're like terrorists. I'm just saying the phenomenon is the same. And the new one is in the liberal left. The resistance is much bigger than just the Democrats. And so how do we bring the virtual world and the physical world together for progress rather than destroying each other or becoming a destructive force? I don't think we've cracked that. And really, it's, do you know your neighbor as well as you know your friends and followers on social media?
Absolutely. It's not just about cutting down on those 3 to 5 hours, but what do you fill that time with? What do you do with that time?
Right.
It's a fantastic book, and it's a very important book, and I'm so grateful that we had you here to talk about it today. Thanks so much, Clint.
Thanks for having me.
I'm D.W. Gibson. I've been speaking with former FBI Special Agent Clint Watts about his new book, Messing with the Enemy.